Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null. I'm getting up
soon in the morning. Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We have a lot on health issues to discuss. We're going to talk about how Texas A&M University showed that dried plums provide protection for your bone, especially if you've had radiation, and therefore people who have radiation are not told you're going to end up with a lot of demineralization. Women active a few times a week have a lower risk of heart disease, stroke, and blood clots, from University of Oxford. We're also going to talk about vitamin D. That's our sunshine vitamin, how it can prevent and treat diseases associated with aging, Loyola University. And scientists unravel the bioavailability of brown seaweed. Most people don't eat seaweed. They should. And I'll explain why, and a lot more on health and healing. And then from our environmental segment today, we're going to look at, from the University of Delaware, how the evergreens are at risk. Now, I've enjoyed, throughout my adult life, traveling to different places in America. And one of my favorites is out in the area of Colorado, Wyoming, Montana, South Dakota, North Dakota, New Mexico, some of Nevada, Northern California, beautiful area there. And what you notice are the evergreens, especially when you're at the higher elevation. If you're in Phoenix, you land at the lowest elevation, so it's boiling hot. But then you go 2.5 hours north of Phoenix, and you're in a wonderful area, small, about 11,000, 12,000 people, called Sedona. And you're driving, and it all looks kind of bushy, and then you come up over this little knoll, and there are the beautiful red mountains. And you can drive through the whole thing in 10 minutes. But then you go another hour, hour and a half north of that. Now you're up at Flagstaff. That's where the university is. And then if you keep going a little further beyond that, you get to the highest point. And that's where you can see for miles. And it's all forest. Now it's not. Everywhere we have forests that are dying. Over 80 million trees are being affected by the beetles. Why? Climate change. Also from our environmental segment today, methane emissions in the Arctic cold season are higher than expected. Well, that's not good news. I'll explain why as well. And then, claiming to represent science, the global GMO industry is really built upon fear, fraud, and corruption. The ecologist Colin Todhunter talks about that. Time permitting, Chris Hedges, Truth Dig, The Creeping Villainy of American Politics. And also, I want to play some audio clips today. I want to have you listen to a psychiatrist talk about antidepressants and why they're dangerous. I also want to remind people that we should have a national movement, first for high-speed trains. Boy, would that save an awful lot of pollution if we could, let's say, get on a high-speed bullet train, as they have in China and Japan and France, and go from New York to Florida in, let's say, 5 hours instead of 27 hours, or flying in 3 hours. Also, we could go from New York to Los Angeles or other points. We're not supporting that at this moment. We should. But also, we should support completely upgrading our electrical grids. Now, whether those electrical grids are powered by conventional technologies or alternative technologies is not for the debate at this moment. Ideally, we want alternative non-polluting technologies. Wave, solar, wind, geothermal. Right now we have gas, oil, coal. Not good. But they're ancient, and they're very susceptible. and what would be the disaster, the worst disaster that could possibly happen in America, if a solar ray, a bloom of electroplasma comes off the sun, which it does every day, but a big one, like the Carrington one in the 1800s, if that hit today, all life in America would be disrupted. I want to have you listen to a short 2.5-minute piece from an expert in the field. And for those who think that Hillary Clinton has got the black vote locked up, maybe she does. But for those who want to share information on why she is not your best friend, does not have your back, we'll play a segment. If we have time, a Dr. Shashi Tharoor says that Britain does owe reparations. Now, it's not that a lot of us believe Britain owes reparations, but it's the history lesson that he teaches us that is so valuable, lest we forget. So that's what we have today, a wide variety of topics, as we like to honor audiences all over the world. And remember, we are worldwide. If you Google liberal radio, we're number one. If you Google progressive radio, we're number one. We're the number one voice for progressive, independent thinking people. And that's why we have so much diversity in our programming. Let's begin. We always begin with the latest on health and healing. Now, one area that everyone would agree is that we need more fruits and vegetables. Well, when you have a plum and a plum dries, you end up with a prune. According to Texas A&M University and a Dr. Nancy Turner there, she did some research and she found that her team of researchers were able to show that eating those dried plums protects from radiation-induced bone loss. The paper's entitled Dried Plum Protects from Bone Loss Caused by Ionizing Radiation, and it's published in Science Reports. Now, why is this important? Because every day, people are getting x-rays. Some are getting dental x-rays. It's still an x-ray. It's still ionizing radiation. And no matter what they try to do, and I believe they do their best to try to protect all of us who may need an x-ray versus getting an x-ray because, well, it's defensive medicine. They want to give you everything they can. Least off, if you sue them, they have themselves covered. But that means that you have these hydroxyl-free radicals really careening around in your body. Just imagine the old 1950s golf carts and where you bumper cars, you would get in and drive and everybody bumped everyone. Now imagine that times 100 billion, and that's what goes on after you get an x-ray or radiation. You have massive amounts, almost unfathomable amounts of free radicals in your body. The immune system is not able to trap them. Even with large amounts of vitamin C, you can't trap and neutralize all these free radicals. So anything that can help prevent the damage from free radicals in an x-ray is good. And one of the problems is that we become demineralized. Osteoporosis is very common when people have had x-rays. So this report says, have some dried plums. Protects you. So the study showed consuming dried plums can protect from ionizing radiation that increases oxidative damage to skeletal tissues and results in an imbalance in bone remodeling. So it's that simple. Nothing complicated there. I would suggest about 4 plums a day. And by the way, plums also are loaded with polyphenols that are high in antioxidants and anti-inflammatory. And they're really good if you have constipation. University of Oxford, peer-reviewed journal Circulation, which is the American Heart Association journal. Women who are active just a few times a week have a lowered risk of heart disease, stroke, and blood clots. Quote from the study, middle-aged women who are physically active a few times a week have lower risk of heart disease, stroke, and blood clots than inactive women. The more frequently you exercise, the better it is. Women who perform strenuous physical activity, enough to cause sweating or faster heartbeat 2 to 3 times a week were 20% less likely to develop heart disease, strokes, and blood clots compared to participants who reported little or no activity. And among active women, there was little evidence of further risk reduction with more frequent activity. Now, that's important because here's what they're not putting together, and I believe that we should understand this. One of the problems that we have is the food that we consume frequently has a lot of saturated fats. When these lipids go into the blood, they tend to coalesce. They come together. They clump, aggregate. That's not good. And because that's what can form a clot. Therefore, keeping our blood thinner is the key. So when you're exercising, if you exercise and keep the blood thinner simultaneously, and especially after you exercise, that's a really double positive. How do you do that? Well, first, do about 45 minutes to an hour of aerobic exercise, then about a half hour of resistance exercise. You've got to hit both groups. Then, before you exercise, take some nutrients that are known to protect your heart and thin your blood, like cayenne pepper. Cayenne you can get in capsule, or you can make your own. Just get some cayenne. There's different types of cayenne, and the quality of the cayenne is based upon its heat unit value. Around 40,000 heat units is a good amount, and it's not going to hurt. It actually turns off pain and helps heal problems in the intestines, stomach, ulcers. But what it really does, which is great, it thins the blood. Now you take coenzyme Q10, it strengthens the heart, energizing the heart with the mitochondria increase in the brain. Vitamin E from mixed tocopherols and tocotrienols, about 400 units of this. L-carnitine, carn, C-A-R-N, teen, carnitine at about 1,000 milligrams energizes the heart. Also, magnesium is probably your single most important mineral to prevent a heart attack. And taking it at about 800 milligrams is really terrific. That's the best insurance you can do for heart attacks. It also helps with a lot of other conditions in the body, but that I'm only talking now about why you should take it. So now what you've done, and I'm not even talking about all the others, hawthorn and ginkgo biloba. I'm just talking about the basics. Take those before exercise. They'll stay in your blood for hours. So now you get the benefit of the exercise. That's, they're saying, is 20%. But also, a lot of the women who are exercising are not always understanding they must compensate for the oxidative stress. So this is the compensation. So it's keeping their blood healthy and thin. Water, and what I would suggest drinking before you go out for an exercise, is 50-50. 50% of green tea, hot or cold, and mix that with coconut water. Now, that's the best single tonic, electrolyte, and heart remedy because of the potassium, 400 to 500 milligrams of potassium. So that is terrific for you. So now you're getting the benefit of the exercise, and you're benefiting your biochemistry, your hormones, antioxidants, polyphenols. So you can then take that 20% up, way up high. They haven't done the research, but that is what I would suggest. Now, vitamin D, we know, is a universally important nutrient. One of the things we need is to understand that it prevents diseases associated with aging. This was published in the Journal of Aging and Gerontology. It was done at Loyola University, Marcella Niehoff School of Nursing. And the research reviewed evidence that suggests an association between vitamin D, if you're deficient in it, and premature aging. For example, you're going to have worse cognitive decline, depression, osteoporosis, cardiovascular disease, higher blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and cancer. That's how important vitamin D is. Quote, vitamin D deficiency is a common serious medical condition that significantly affects the health and well-being of older adults. End quote. Dr. Sue Pinkofer, a professor at the university. So if you're over the age of 40, make sure that you're getting 3,000 to 5,000 units a day of vitamin D3. That would be important. Also, scientists are suggesting that the brown seaweeds are really good and that they understand how they're digested in the large intestine, that they're anti-inflammatory. In other words, they're really good for us. So those cultures around the world that have been using seaweed on the African Ivory Coast, on the South Africa, on Cape Horn, on the northern parts of Africa, where you have access to seaweed, they have historically used it, but so have the Chinese and the Japanese. They're more famous for it because it's a major part of their cuisine. We, not so much. We don't eat seaweed. We should, but people say, I don't like the taste of it. It's kind of this fishy, smelly. Okay, what you do is this. You do rinse and wash. Rinse and wash, rinse and wash. Three times. Meaning you rinse it through a colander, put it in a bowl, fill the bowl up, agitate it, and dump the water out. You do that three times. Then you cook the seaweed at a low temperature for about 10 to 15 minutes. That loosens up that really strong fibrous material. Now you can either use it hot or cold. It's delicious. I make a seaweed salad where I will take that seaweed, doesn't matter whether it's kombu or wakame, hijiki, and you put it in a bowl. And to that bowl, you dice up some sweet onion, and you put the sweet onion in. You also can put in some sauerkraut and some sweet relish with mustard and a little grated horseradish. Now, this is a terrific thing if you have a cold or flu, but it's also great tasting. And you stir it around. Add in some extra virgin olive oil and let it marinate overnight. Then the next day, you have a seaweed salad. So you get a red, nice bed of lettuce, whatever kind you like, and you put this in the middle of it, garnish it, and you have a delicious dish. Or you put it inside of a scooped out avocado, and now you have a stuffed avocado. So there's a lot you can do with it. Or you can use it hot. And I suggest people always start easy. Make some brown rice, and then take some warmed up seaweed and stir fry shiitake mushrooms with toasted sesame oil and some gamoshi, which is a toasted sesame seed, and some garlic sauteed. So you got your seaweed, garlic, all lightly toasted and sauteed in a sesame, toasted sesame oil, and then you mix that into brown rice. So this way you are combining until you get really adapted to his taste, you're making seaweed an important part of your meal, but it won't be in and of itself overwhelming. By the way, I've been in restaurants where they specialize in seaweeds around the world, and you can imagine how many hundreds of varieties of edible seaweed there are. Mushrooms are also good. From the University of Colombo in Sri Lanka, a preparation of the mushrooms, two types. One is, I'll spell it for you so you can write it down, because this is good for diabetics. In other words, if you have this mushroom while eating a meal, it helps lower your after-meal blood sugar. So that would help you with your insulin levels. And you can, it's a freeze-dried mushroom powder. It's the American oyster mushroom. And there's also one called the abalone, A-B-A-L-O-N-E, mushroom. Those two are terrific. Now, if you want the technical name, it is P-L-E-U-R-O-T-U-S, P-L-E-U-R-O-T-U-S. Second word, O-S-T-R-E-A-T-U-S. But just ask for the American oyster mushroom extract. So if you're diabetic, have that capsule, that's all. And that can help make a difference, maintaining your blood sugar level. If you're over the age of 50, according to the Women's University, the Hee University in Korea, you need a B-complex to help you with cognitive boost. So quote, supplementation with vitamin B6, B12, and folic acid may improve cognitive function in older people with mild cognitive impairment. This was a 12-week study where they gave people B-complex each day, and it lowered their homocysteine level. That's good. You don't want an elevated homocysteine. And this was published in the Journal of Nursing Scholarship. So B-complex, my suggestion, 50 milligrams a day. So that's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a brief break and come back. Please stay with us.
I'm going to play John Henry here this evening for you all. I'm going to tell you why John Henry fell dead. At home on his mother's knee, crying that big in a tunnel on that wire. Mama's gonna be the
dead. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. I want to hit some environmental issues for us. First up, the wild bee decline threatens U.S. crop production. This is from the University of Vermont. I'll read it for you. It says, a new study of wild bees identifies 139 counties in key agricultural regions of California in the Pacific Northwest and the upper Midwest and the Great Plains and West Texas and the southern Mississippi River Valley that have the most worrisome mismatch between falling wild bee supply and rising crop pollination demand. The study was just published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. What this means in lay language is that just when we need more food in the states I just mentioned, in the areas I mentioned, we have greater decline. And in fact, it's 39% of U.S. croplands depends upon pollinators, from apple orchards to pumpkin patches. In fact, one out of every three types of food grown in America requires bees to pollinate. And so we're getting decimated. The bees are not there, so the foods are not being pollinated. And why? Well, simple. Neonicotinoids, these are the pesticides. Will the White House, will the U.S. Department of Agriculture acknowledge this? No, they will not. It's political and economic, because the people who give the contributions to the campaigns are the big ag businesses. And as a result, they hold a lot of power. And they're always smart to know who to get elected into different from different states into Congress, and they protect their interests, not the public's. So what to do? Well, the first thing is become aware of how important bees are to our future. Then take it upon yourself to have a small bee collective. Bees are wonderful. You don't have to have a lot to do a lot of pollinating. One hive can hold, 30, 40,000 bees. And you just see an abundance of things pollinating where otherwise it may not pollinate. I've always had bees. I'm a beekeeper, so I have bees on my ranch, and they keep everything healthy. But they wouldn't be that way if I sprayed pesticides on it, or if in the wintertime I didn't give them their own honey. I don't use anything from the bee. I give it all back. And that way they're guaranteed 12 months a year to have everything they need. And therefore they live a more idyllic life, and I get the benefit of having everything pollinated. We need to do that everywhere. We need to get more citizens to start doing bee culture so that we can then become informed, share this information in high schools and colleges and communities. In fact, get a whole community. Have your block be the block that has some bees in the backyard or bees in buildings, on the roof of buildings to pollinate, and start campaigns. That's what I would suggest. Evergreens at risk, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, according to a paper just published in Nature Climate Change, predicts widespread death of the needle-leaf evergreen trees within the southwest United States. And I see it when I'm in Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, California, Utah, Texas. And in fact, the U.S. Department of Agriculture Forest Services. It is home to 11 national forests, spanning almost 20 million acres in Arizona and New Mexico alone. And yet, because the climate change is getting so hot and it's so dry, the trees and the understory vegetation, such as shrubs and bushes, sequester carbon from the atmosphere. And less vegetation means less carbon capture, which can create a negative feedback loop that can accelerate climate change. And that's why we keep saying, don't tear down the rainforest. The rainforests are the lungs of the planet. The rainforest is where you take in that carbon and it creates a carbon sink. When you cut down the trees so that you can either sell the trees or grow genetically engineered soybeans to ship off to the United States or China, what you're doing is you're creating deforestation. And that means then you create a desert. In fact, there are thousands of miles of desert in South America where once there wasn't. Also, the Arctic is going through a rough time right now. In fact, a new study just out from Open University and University of Sheffield and with scientists from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Harvard University, they're saying methane emissions in the Arctic cold season are higher than expected. That's not good. Why? Because look at what happens. When it's frozen, then all that methane stays in the ground, buried deep underground. But when it thaws, when it has a warm winter, as we're having now, in fact, probably the warmest winter for the Arctic in our recorded history, it means then that the ground no longer is rock solid frozen. It thaws and methane starts to come up, lots of it. That creates a feedback loop. The more methane that comes up, the more climate change accelerates, and then you end up with more and more methane. So we should pay attention to methane. It's going to be a major problem in the future. And Colin Todhunter has this to say about GMOs, genetically modified organisms. Quote, the more the GM industry claims to enjoy the support of science, the more it resorts to emotive assault and attack against its opponents while doing its best to suppress the many scientific truths that are not to its liking. In truth, it is driven by profit politics and ideology and is based upon fraud and the capture and corruption of governments and regulators. Critics of GM promote pseudoscience, make false claims based upon ignorance, and are driven by political motivated ideology. So they claim. The actions of these affluent elitists effectively deny food to the hungry. They are therefore committing crimes against humanity. If you follow the GM issue, no doubt you've heard this kind of simplistic, tired, and predictable diatribe before. The good deal of the debate surrounding GMOs involves attacking critics of the technology whose voice genuine concern and put forward valid arguments to back up their cases. The attack by the pro-GMO lobby are nonsensical because there are sufficient, credible evidence that questions the safety, efficacy, and science used to promote GM, genetically modified foods, as well as the politics and practice used to get GMOs on the commercial market. So he's saying what a lot of us have known, that virtually never trust, unchallenged, what you hear coming from the pro-GMO side of the equation, whether it's a legislator or a government body like the USDA, or the media, because the media more often than not sides with those who do the advertising or who have the power. In fact, read the articles. I have written several articles, some with Richard Gale, on the subject of GMOs, the truth, dispelling the myths. It's a real important primer, and it's free. It's a public service. Go to the Progressive Radio Network or Parian.fm. Download the articles. And by the way, they're doing the same thing when they have front groups, what are called AstroTurf groups, that are just industry fronts with friendly-sounding names, and all they do is attack anyone who challenges the safety and efficacy of vaccines. But they've also done this with anyone attacking pharmaceuticals or psychiatry. You know, there's no shortages of money and people they can hire to attack you if you have the truth, and that truth challenges them. And that brings me to something that is of concern, and that is In the United States and many places around the world, we have a lot of hate crimes occurring against Muslims, especially since the Paris and San Bernardino attacks, and the acceptance of hate speech is a legitimate form of political discourse, signaling the morbidity of our civil society. And Chris Hedges, as always, gives us uniquely perceptive insights into the body politic. Why? Because it's coughing up blood. The daily amplification of this hate speech by a commercial media whose sole concern is ratings and advertising dollars, rather than serving as a bulwark to protect society, presages a descent into the proto-fascist nightmare of racism and indiscriminate violence against the marginalized and the blind celebration of American chauvinism, militarism, and bigotry. The mounting attacks on Muslims, which will become a contagion when there is another catastrophic terrorist attack, are only the beginning. There's a long list of targeted individuals, including undocumented workers, African Americans, homosexuals, liberals, feminists, intellectuals, and artists. We are entering a new dark age, an age of idiocy and blood. These hatreds encoded in American DNA, but understood as politically toxic by the liberal wing of the capitalist class, have been embraced by an enraged and disenfranchised white underclass. Our failure to curb this hate speech will haunt us. And once a civil society tolerates the intolerant, as Karl Popper wrote, the tolerant will be destroyed and tolerance with him. The anti-Muslim virus begins slowly. Step by step, the hate talk moves from insults, stereotyping, and untruths to incendiary calls for vigilantes to attack women wearing the hijab, men wearing the kufis, mosques, Islamic centers and schools, and Muslim-owned businesses. It makes sense to many in the white underclass, especially because they have been sold out by the liberals who preach tolerance, that the violent purging of a demonized group from the United States society can cure the society's malaise and restore safety and American greatness. But soon all marginalized groups will be at risk. Such a process is what happened in the Weimar Republic. It happened in Yugoslavia. It is what's happening now in Israel. And that is what Kierkegaard said was the creeping villainy, is that it takes considerable imagination and considerable dialectical abilities to be able to detect it at the moment and see it for what it is. Glenn Beck had a best-selling book called It's About Islam, Exposing the Truth About ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Iran, and the Caliphate. And he posits that a quarter of American Muslims, that's somewhere between 300 and 500,000, believe that violence should be used to overthrow the state and annul the Constitution in order to replace our judicial system with Sharia law. That's what he believes would be their motive. He says Islam keeps followers living in the Stone Age. His rant against Muslims parallels his rants against undocumented workers. He once, for example, said there are only three reasons Mexicans come to the United States. One, they're terrorists. Two, they're escaping the law. And three, they're hungry. They can't make a living in their own dirtbag country. That's exactly what he said, his words. This is repulsive. This extremism, expressed by Beck and many others, is moving with terrifying speed to the center of American political debate. And the mainstream press, which prizes sensationalism over news and truth, has abrogated its role as an arbiter of fact and rational discourse to peddle spectacle and sensationalism. And that is the problem. The indiscriminate violence unleashed by the United States against Muslim countries in the Middle East has at the same time radicalized whole populations which are bombed and otherwise terrorized daily. Obama talks about the hateful, vengeful ideology we're up against, but he is not addressing the hate that hate produced. The current presentation of the conflict is irrational, as if Muslims hate us for being free in our way of life. Undeniably, envy and resentment have their parts to play, but that is not the major factor. It is a small variable. The problem is the violence and brutalization that has occurred in the Muslim world. Pakistani children in areas under drone attacks hate sunny days because of the drones, which don't function in cloudy weather. The only days they feel comfortable playing in northern Pakistan is on a cloudy day because the drones can't see them. That's terror, and that has consequences. And the lust for brutality is not limited to groups such as the Islamic State. It is more than matched by numerous voices in the West. And we have an awful lot of unbalanced people here. The backlash against the settling of thousands of Syrian and Iraqi and Afghan refugees also plays into the hands of the Islamic State. ISIS condemns the West as unfit for Muslims. It holds up its self-proclaimed caliphate as a sanctuary and refuge for Sunni Muslims. If Western nations accept large number of refugees, many fleeing ISIS-controlled territory, they shatter this belief. By turning refugees away, they legitimate the bifurcation of the world into Muslim and non-Muslim. Just something to think about. I'm Gary Knoll. One more thing. I want to share an insight from an article I read from The Smirking Chimp, The Saudi's Impunity, by Eric Zola. No matter how bad the fundamentalist Sunni Islamic Saudi royal family are, here's the issue. Americans, our government, still support Saudi Arabia and condemns the countries that the Saudis hate. So if Saudis hates Iran, we hate Iran. If Saudi hates Syria, we hate Syria. If Saudi hates Russia, we hate Russia. But when was the last time you were told that virtually all the jihadist terrorism is Sunni? None of it is Shia. But the United States government is anti-Shia and pro-Sunni. There were no Shia involved in the 9/11 attacks, nor in the Mumbai attacks, nor in the Charlie Hebdo or other Paris attacks, nor in the London bombing, nor in any of the others. All the terrorism that racks Afghanistan and Pakistan is Sunni. ISIS is Sunni. Al-Qaeda is Sunni. Al-Nusra is Sunni. So as Sunni fundamentalists, they all hate, especially Shia, as infidels, because Shia claim to be Muslims, and Sunni fundamentalists take that very claim to be not only a lie, but a personal insult to themselves, because they believe they're the only real Muslims, because they believe they know what is a real Muslim. And they've been taught it, and it's distinctly Sunni. So if you're not a Sunni, you're not a Muslim in their minds. But the U.S. government keeps harping instead against the Shia groups like Hezbollah, which is at war against Israel because the barbaric way the Israelis treat its Palestinians. But that's not terrorism in anything like the same sense. It's not jihadist. It's not out of global conquest. It certainly doesn't threaten us. And it's really none of America's business to get involved with anyway. This is the Israeli issue. The Israelis flagrantly violated even the Camp David Accords that the U.S. government itself brokered. And so for America to be involved on either side there is plain wrong. But the U.S. government donates from its own taxpayers over $3 billion a year to Israel so that it'll buy weapons from the U.S. arms makers. This giveaway the U.S. weapons industry is benefiting from is called humanitarian. I'd like to know what is humanitarian with cluster bombs. This is not foreign aid. It actually aids more in killing than it does in protecting. The sheer hypocrisy of that subsidy to U.S. weapons makers is obscene. But anyway, Hezbollah is a sideshow in a discussion of terrorism, and it's not at all jihadist. By contrast, the Saud family fund jihad, and yet the U.S. government considers them allies. The Bushes love them. Something's very wrong here. The Saudis have impunity, at least in the U.S. government. Instead, the U.S. government being against the tyrants who rule Saudi Arabia. The U.S. government overthrows the leaders who are allied with Russia. Who were that? Well, Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi and the Russian-friendly Viktor Yanukovych. And our government is allied with the Saudis and other top funders of terrorism. Who are the main funders of terrorism who are now looking to overthrow Bashar al-Assad because he's not a Sunni. He's a Shia. Well, just take a look in the Middle East. The big producers, funders, trainers, protectors of terrorists, Qatar, the royals there, Kuwaiti royals, United Arab Emirate royals, these are all Arabic oil royal families, and they're all led by Saudi's king, the world's wealthiest person, and the organizer of the new Saudi-run Sunni version of America's NATO alliance against Russia. And they're all fighting in Yemen, and they couldn't beat the Yemenis, poorest country in the Middle East. Ever since 1744, when the gang leader, Muhammad Saad, and the fanatically anti-Shia Sunni preacher, Muhammad Wahhab, swore their mutual oath to one another, the Saads have hated Shia and been set upon to defeat them. That oath started what we today call Saudi Arabia, a union of church and state, the Saudi government with Wahhabist clerics validating that family's authority to rule, that seeks first to exterminate all Shia Muslims and then to organize all Muslims together into a global conquest to bring every nation under strict Sunni rule. And that's where they come to their beheading and crucifixion. Wahhab hated Shia for their trying to soften the original Islam. Wahhabism is called Salafism when it's being practiced outside the Muslim Holy Land of Saudi Arabia, but its principles are the same under either name. ISIS is also the same as Saudi, except that it demands the global Islamic leader to be a descendant of the Prophet. Ah, that's a rub, which the Saudis are not. In this regard, ISIS poses a real threat to the Saudi Arabians. ISIS then is an enemy of the Saudis inside Saudi Arabia, but a useful fighting organization for the Saudis outside of Saudi Arabia. So what do they think they're going to do? They'll fund, train, protect ISIS in all of their destruction, and then once they've taken over Saudi Arabia, once they have taken over Iraq, once they've taken over Libya, they're then going to what? Go in and torch them, nuke them, kill them all? It's not going to happen. What will happen more likely is that demon they've created will come back to haunt them. Because remember, the Saudis are not the direct descendants. And as a result, only the caliphate says we will be led by that which is pure and fundamentalist. So you have to understand the back, way back, long ago, Muhammad Saad began by leading armies into the Najdi, which is today Saudi towns and villages, to eradicate various popular Shia practices. The movement helped to rally the towns and tribes around the Saudi Wahhabi standard. And by 1765, Muhammad Saad's forces had established Wahhabism and with it al-Saad political authority. Furthermore, by marrying his son into the al-Wahhabi tribe, Muhammad Saad broke with the custom by initiated a process that led to the unification of disparate tribes under one ruler. In return for their alliance, Muhammad Saad offered his followers the prospect of conquest. And in 1746, Al-Wahhab issued a formal proclamation of jihad against all those who refused to share his vision of unity. And hence, today, inside of Saudi Arabia, it's the Saudi family, the Saud family, who finances Al-Qaeda. And they finance all these terrorists. And they finance the 9/11 terrorists as well. I'm Gary Nall. Just a little perspective on history. Now let's go over and listen to a psychiatrist talk about the dangers of antidepressants. It's a short clip, but very insightful.
Hi, I'm Dr. Kelly Brogan, and I'd like to spend a few minutes speaking to you about my perspectives on psychiatric medications, which I began to investigate based on my perceptions of the severe limitations of this treatment model. So I'll tour you through four tenets that I appreciate in my daily practice. So the first is that depression is not a serotonin deficiency. As somebody who writes and lectures about inflammatory and nutrient-driven models of depression, it surprises me to learn how much of the population believes that serotonin deficiency causes depression. And this notion first came into existence through observations of medication side effects in tuberculosis patients. But in 6 decades since, we have yet to confirm in human studies the role of the monoamines, serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine, or the 100 other neurochemicals in depression. And this has led leaders in the field to begin to admit that we need to abandon the monoamine hypothesis, which makes sense because high levels of serotonin and low metabolite have been associated with very undesirable outcomes such as suicide and bulimia. And we know that the use of L-tryptophan, an amino acid that is a precursor to serotonin, only changes mood states when it is used in patients who have been previously treated with antidepressants. So you might wonder, well, how is it that antidepressants work so well? And that brings me to the second tenet, which is that the active placebo effect is responsible for antidepressant benefit. And this is an idea that was pioneered through the research of Dr. Irving Kirsch, which demonstrated that up to 73% of the perceived benefit of antidepressants is attributed to the active placebo effect and the passage of time. And the active placebo effect is when in a clinical trial, a patient becomes aware that they are not receiving placebo, that they are receiving the treatment, and they become aware of that through the side effects that they're experiencing. And when he uncovered unpublished data, more than half of which was negative in nature, and included that, this benefit disappeared. And even in the most severe depression, 1 point on a 52-point scale was all that distinguished treatment from placebo. And this 1 point could easily be attributed to side effects rather than the actual mechanism of the medication. So you can see how we have a scientific vacuum here. And in psychiatry, there are no objective tests to diagnose. We use a manual that's a list of descriptors. And we have created an opportunity for pharmaceutical companies to infect a vulnerable host. And what I mean by that is that we have patients who are suffering, they're looking for answers, and they're looking for a cure. And they are led to believe by direct-to-consumer advertising that all of these things are known and available. So what are the problems with this, with the placebo effect? Well, that leads me to the third tenet, which is that these medications cause significant and lasting perturbations to the nervous system. And this happens because when you're chronically exposed to a pharmaceutical product, your body makes adaptations to accommodate that. It creates a new normal state rather than actually resolving a pathology. And when you discontinue a medication, the adaptation back to previous baseline can be very difficult. And this has been termed a relapse. And data suggests that those who are treated with medications relative to those who are not are much, much more likely to relapse. And in fact, moreover, they're more likely to experience decline in functioning and a compromised quality of life long term. And there has never been a study that has demonstrated that medication treatment long term provides better outcomes. So this brings me to my fourth and final tenet, which is that there is a better way. Through personalized diagnostics and lifestyle medicine, you can identify the actual root cause of a depression and intervene naturally for lasting outcomes. So thank you so much for listening.
So now I'm going to finish off our program. We'll see if we can get up the cost of the Trans-Pacific Partnership will be bad for America. It'll be really bad for smaller countries. We should all let our representatives know we are opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We'll listen to this segment.
The signing of the TPP marks only the beginning of the fight. Peter Mabarduke, Director of Public Citizens Global Access to Medicines Program, thank you for joining me today.
Good to be here.
So from an American perspective, how can this deal pit pharmaceuticals against patients in ways the typical person might not anticipate?
All right, so the TPP is only partly about things most people would consider typical of a trade agreement. Many powerful industry lobby groups put in packages of their own to transform countries' laws and work in the interests of big business. And one is the pharmaceutical lobby pushed very hard to expand their monopoly power to include rules that will change our laws to drive up the price of medicines. They can charge whatever they want. It could affect our ability in the United States to negotiate better prices through Medicare. It locks us into a series of bad rules that we have in the U.S. now that can't keep cancer treatment prices high, prices of other medicines very high. And the costs are potentially even more severe for developing countries that are resource short. Countries are going to have to decide between buying 50 new hospital beds in a hospital or providing one person with $100,000 a year cancer treatment. It's not a choice countries should have to make.
Well, it's got to undergo a two-year ratification process. What are organizations like yours looking at right now as a way to fight this or at least stop it?
It's largely about the congressional fight in the United States, which is expected to be very close, hinging on relatively few votes. And so far, it seems the Obama administration does not believe that it has the votes to win this fight. People are increasingly learning about the negative consequences of the agreement for workers, for our environment, for the regulations that keep us safe. And we expect it to be a very tough legislative fight in 2016.
What are the major fears that you're hearing people ask you about when it comes to TPP? Obviously, your expertise is medicine. But what do you think the biggest fears are for people if this agreement goes through?
Well, of course, people are afraid of job loss, and they're also afraid of an investment dispute system that allows companies to sue governments over our public interest regulations in secretive tribunals that aren't accountable to our courts. So that gives major corporations an opportunity to attack all the rules that keep our water clean, just take care of the basic interests that we take for granted day to day, to attack those rules in a forum that's not accountable to our democratic system, to defend what they would call their investment interests.
So it's a sovereignty issue.
There are big sovereignty issues at stake, and big issues of the big business lobby has tremendous access to this process in a way that citizens do not. And so we've been fighting 5 years to sort of spread the word about the kind of bad ideas that are being put in this agreement that could drive up the cost of medicine for many of us.
Organizations like yours, it's, I imagine, an uphill battle. What are you trying to do to get the congressional vote on your side? Is it just lobbying? Is it public education? How do you approach something like this?
Well, this is sunlight is the best disinfectant. The more that people learn about the TPP, the more they're going to oppose it. These deals are really there for big business to try and operate the way they want to operate, free of regulation. All around the world. And the more that average people understand about what's actually in these deals, that they're not trade deals, but really just big business giveaways, the more votes we think we pick up.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me today.
And that's just to keep us reminded that we should let our national leaders know, our legislators, we the people oppose what the government, at least some members of the government, our president, we're negotiating in secret for these years. Just use common sense and reason. If these were trade agreements that would benefit us, they would have made it public. They would have been transparent. The fact that these were super secret, that about 500 major corporations and lobbyists were allowed to give input and write the rules, that means that they have, for all intents and purposes, made an effort to shred our Constitution and all of our Bill of Rights. It's time for the average person to wake up out of the malaise, turn off the television, stop the reality show watching, and look at this reality unfolding him right in front of him, because a lot of people are going to lose their job. And then what are they going to say when someone says, you lost your job? Yeah. And they've increased debtors' prisons and you're behind in your payments, so they could come and arrest you? Yeah. Did you do anything about it? No. Why not? I didn't want to miss my ball game. I didn't want to be bothered. I'm sure there was someone else looking after me. Wake up time. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.